been driving a Range Rover. Been jumping the new science.
And I've been kicking the new knowledge.
And I've seen to a degree that you can't get in college.
It's the sound of science. The sound of science. Science.
Yes, it certainly is the sounds of science. The sweet, sexy, sciencey sounds of diffusion. And this week, we've got more interesting tidbits than Yum Cha in Chinatown. Ian is going to be looking at a duck's quack. Yes, you heard me. And Catherine will be looking into mood-dependent memory. And if we can find anything else to squeeze into a half-hour show, we will. But this week, to kick us off, we've got something a little different. Instead of the normal diffusion science news we usually bring you, we have some stories from the 1926 edition of the Science Newsletter. So here's some old-school science as read by Justin Zeltzer.
When there is one motor car to every four persons in the United States, which is now estimated as the saturation point, and oil wells stop producing, what will America do for gas? This problem wrinkled the brows of scientists gathered in Philadelphia for the 72nd meeting of the American Chemical Society, and many schemes were suggested for keeping the wolf from the garage door. The United States has 100,000 motor cars 20 years ago, and today she has nearly 20 million, Dr. A.C. Fieldner explained. Dr. Fieldner is the chief chemist of the Pittsburgh Department of the U.S. Bureau of Mines. He has also noted that the United States owns 5/6 of all the motor cars and trucks in the world, and uses 80% of the motor fuel. Nearly all of this motor fuel is gasoline, made from petroleum, and the petroleum supply in the United States is definitely limited. The engines of motor cars, Dr. Fieldner said, are very inefficient users of fuel. The mileage could be doubled if the engines of greater gas compression were used with anti-knock gasoline, and the supply of petroleum could be made to last some years longer. A new method of cheaper synthesis of a high-grade motor fuel in Germany may go far towards the solution of the motor fuel problem in the future. The Berlin professor, Franz Fischer, who recently devised a means of making liquid fuels synthetically from coal products, has now simplified his process so that he can dispense with the costly high-pressure apparatus that has stood in the way of its commercial development. The new method produces a pleasant-smelling gasoline, as clear as water, and one which will not harden or become gummy on exposure. The gasoline is highly volatile and is largely made up of unsaturated compounds, like olefins, which impart to the gasoline valuable anti-knock properties. This enables it to be used in efficient high-compression motors, without objectionable knocking and with great economy. And now to entertainment news. People who have had to miss the movies because they hurt their eyes may go in perfect comfort and ease to the coloured ones that are now being developed. Professor Leonard T. Trolland of the Psychology Department of Harvard University has made a study of both kinds of movies and gives the coloured ones a clean bill of health.
Some old school science from Justin there.
And ferocity of bears. Oh, it's a fact, so deal with that. It's a fact, yeah, deal with that. The moon is moving away from the earth by 4 centimetres a year. And when it's gone, we are all well and truly buggered. Oh, it's a fact, so deal with that. It's a fact. So deal with that. Blue whales are bloody massive. Their tongues weigh as much as an elephant. Its heart is the size of a car, and some of its blood vessels are so wide that you could swim down them. Oh, it's a fact. So you deal with that. It's a fact. So deal with that. Your average pillow of about 6 years old is made up from 1/10 of skin, living mites, dead mites, and mite dung. Oh, it's a fact, so deal with that. It's a fact, so deal with that. That's a fact. You deal with that. It's a fact. Deal with that. Ducks, quacks don't make up. Fact.
I have a riddle for you. How can something not be true, be widely believed, and yet not be a myth? The widely distributed belief that a duck's quack doesn't echo has its basis in reality, and yet it isn't true. Ian Wolfe explains.
A duck's quack doesn't echo, says the guy at the pub. And then his eyes gets very big, and he says, and nobody knows why. The riddle is that it isn't true, it's widely believed, but it's not a myth, because there is some reality behind it. How can this be? The answer is, it's an illusion. Fooling the ear this way takes us into the auditory illusion world of psychoacoustics. Psychoacoustics, by analysing the way our ears and brains are fooled, has led to the development of MP3 and other sound file compression techniques that work by throwing away the 80% that you just won't notice is gone. It's also being used to provide surround sound from just two speakers and a whole range of useful tricks. An echo is a reflection of sound from a surface, just like the reflection of light from a mirror, and heard by the listener sometime after the original sound. For example, the echo reflected off Timmy down the well, or by the walls of a room, or the side of a cliff. A true echo is a single reflection of the sound source. If the surface you're reflecting the sound from is less than 16 metres away, then your ear won't hear the echo. This is because the delay between the original sound and the reflected sound isn't big enough for you to be able to tell the difference. If so many echoes are heard by a listener that they aren't able to tell the difference between them and they just blur together, then they're called reverberation. To eliminate echoes, some performance venues use sound absorbers called diffusers. An anechoic chamber is full of wedges of sound-absorbing diffusers to soak up the extra sound and has no echoes at all. It's a strange experience to stand in one because it's an environment like nothing else you experience in normal life. It gets really quiet really quickly. The University of Salford's Acoustic Research Centre got Daisy the Duck into their acoustics laboratory for the British Association Festival of Science to do the ultimate tests. First, they put her in an anechoic chamber just to hear the unadulterated quack, the real thing, without reflections. No, a duck without reflections is not a vampire. Daisy was just a sitting duck. For the ultimate test of the facts, they put Daisy in a reverberation chamber to hear if she echoes when she quacks. If there are sounds that don't echo, then this would have technological applications. There's a video of the experiments on the Salford University Acoustics website at www.acoustics.salford.ac.uk. It's a duct tape. With a cathedral-like chamber to bounce the sound off, did Daisy's quack echo? I think I hear the sound of a mistaken belief disappearing. Of course, most people's experience of echoes comes from yelling at a cliff, yet ducks rarely fly anywhere near a cliff. So the researchers had to get more creative to give people what they find more intuitive. Having proved that a duck's quack does echo, they felt free to play within an electronics effects box to help us imagine the duck flying past the side of a cliff, 50 metres away. Now, listen carefully, and I think you'll hear how this myth started. Now, listen again to the ordinary quack, and then the quack with one echo. Could you hear the difference? It's very subtle. The duck's quack is quiet, and is not one loud sound like a yell, but sort of a quack, where the second part of the sound can be confused with the echo from the first part. It could be hard to tell the two sounds apart, but to claim that there is no echo is just quackery. You can see Daisy in the acoustics labs at www.acoustics.salford.ac.uk. Daisy lives at Stockley Farm in Cheshire, where she graciously accepts visitors by appointment. A duck's quacks do echo. It's a fact, so deal with that.
Ian Wolfe once again showing us that things aren't always what they seem. The duct tape of the sitting duck disproving quackery can be found at the University of Salford Acoustic Auditory and Video Department website, www.acoustics.salford.ac.uk.
Trapped in conflict, release control, bring me back on track, condemn my soul for the
drown my boys. Never had a choice where we belong, where we belong. I have never rejoiced on the rooms where we
Catherine Behag, who's going to try and convince us that alcohol and memory can mix. Catherine, convince us.
Picture this. You've just stumbled drunkenly home after midnight, having recently left your work's annual party. You have put aside the time between now and tomorrow afternoon to study for tomorrow's meeting, where you will be giving a presentation to your managers. You did not plan on drinking tonight, but somehow it just happened. And now you need to cram as much as possible into your tired, intoxicated brain. You begin studying almost immediately and work into the early hours of the morning, sobering up gradually. By midday, you have finished and you are not nearly as drunk as you were earlier. The question of importance here is, should you drink again before the presentation? According to the theory of mood-dependent memory, the answer is yes, of course you should. Professor Eric Ike from the University of British Columbia explained why you should at this year's International Memory Conference. Mood-dependent memory is when you learn something in a particular affective state or mood, like happiness or sadness. It's easier to remember later if you were placed in the same mood. Discussions of mood-dependent memory have been around for eons, but the first experimental work was done in the 1970s and 1980s. However, going back to the 60s, there was a lot of pharmacological research on drug-dependent memory, which basically tells us that our ability to recall more information will be improved if you take the same drug you did whilst learning the material. There was also a lot of research done on place-dependent memory. I believe a good example of place-dependent memory is a study led by Professor Alan Baddeley. In this study, participants learnt a list of words either underwater or on dry land. Later on, their recall was tested in one of these two contexts. Baddeley found that participants who had learned the words underwater performed better if they were again tested underwater, whereas participants who had learned the words on dry land only record more if they were tested again on dry land. Unfortunately, experimental results on mood-dependent memory, drug-dependent memory, and place-dependent memory have all been like flipping a coin. Eric and his colleagues have been working at determining what factors are responsible for these effects when they do occur, and has successfully isolated 7 or 8. As he says, it's like having a cookbook. When you know the ingredients, you can make a cake. Eric Ike argues that drug-dependent memory and place-dependent memory can all be put under a large umbrella, dubbed mood-dependent memory, which I mentioned earlier. After all, in all of the drug-dependent memory studies, regardless of whether they use sedatives or stimulants, the important factor was whether or not the participant had been given a big enough blast of the drug to alter their mood state. In studies like Baddeley's, Dr. Ike suggests that the way places look at learning and at tests is irrelevant, but the key is that different environments make you feel different. Basically, he is trying to tell us that it is our mood which is the driving force behind all these previous studies. So, how does this knowledge from psychologists help us? Well, I'm currently studying at the University of New South Wales, and one possibility that I find personally relevant is a nail-biting, heart-pounding terror that I experience every session as we file into the examinations rooms to sit our finals. Would it perhaps be beneficial for me to make myself feel terrified whilst I'm studying, perhaps by studying in an examination room? Unfortunately, the answer to this question is not so easy. Firstly, Eric Ike points out that in an essay exam, where students are required to generate their own cues, a match between moods at the time of learning and test is probably important. However, in a multiple choice exam, most of the cues are external, so mood doesn't really come into it. And secondly, yes, if you are extremely anxious or extremely drunk whilst you are studying, you will remember more of what you learnt when you are in a similar mood. However, common sense tells us that being drunk, extremely drunk, or being a highly anxious person will impair your ability to absorb as much information in the first place. Hence, I strongly suggest to you to wait until further research is carried out before you start taking the vodka bottles to work. Cheers.
Catherine, I for one volunteer for that research.
60-second science.
Men may no longer be necessary for the survival of the human race. Dr. Daly of the Children's Hospital in Boston, Massachusetts, has shown that stem cells can be manipulated to form sperm that can potentially fertilize eggs. Sorry, blokes, doesn't look like you'll be needed in future. Researchers obtained stem cells from mouse embryos, culturing them for a week. The cells multiplied to form embryoid bodies, from which sperm was extracted, then injected into unfertilized mouse eggs. These form blastocysts essential to the development of embryos. Of course, researchers have yet to take their work further to see if the technique can actually give birth to live young. They are also interested in the potential success of the technique in human reproduction. So yes, you men out there are necessary, for the time being. This research will also allow scientists to gain invaluable information concerning the treatment of cancers related to abnormalities in germ cells, cells embryos set aside for future reproduction.
60 seconds. Silence. Oh, Mel. Light on.
And finally on Diffusion, we're going to be talking a little about consciousness. Everyone knows we're alive, but why do we know we're alive? Is there a difference between consciousness and knowing you're alive? Guys, what is consciousness? And more importantly, why is consciousness? Why do we experience life as we do where other animals don't?
Well, we're conscious because we have experience of our life. But we do an awful lot of things unconsciously. In fact, we do most things unconsciously. When you walk, you don't think, must lift my leg up, must move it across, must put it down, must not fall over. You just do it. Same as when you talk. You don't think about the words, the grammar. You don't think about the rules. You just talk.
So when people tell you, speak before you talk, actually, no one actually does.
Well, it's better if you think before you talk, because then you actually have an idea about what you want to say. But otherwise, you could be just a zombie.
But we're not actually thinking about the exact words that are going to come out of our mouths at the exact time, like in real time. Is that what you're sort of saying?
We're not thinking consciously about the rules of grammar and how to move our tongue and lips exactly, because that would just slow you down.
But what about other forms of consciousness? Because there are most animals in the world wouldn't actually know they're alive. Is that a true statement to say? Like there's... Like, certainly worms and snails and, like, these so-called lower orders of animals, they don't even know they exist. They're almost plant-like in that they sort of just respond to stimuli and respirate.
Well, my understanding is that the current understanding is that animals' consciousness, it's a matter of degree, not in kind, that, you know, animals have experience of the world, just more limited ranges of choices than we do, and we don't know whether or not they think like we do, but we do know that animals have personalities and they feel things. Whether slugs and snails and things do, that's another matter.
Hmm. Well, I have a question involving not so much responding, but not responding. I used to have a German Shepherd that used to live next door to me, and friends would come over and tell me how loud they thought the dog was next door, but I used to reply that I couldn't actually... never even bothered me. I didn't even know it was... didn't even know he was actually barking. So, I mean, does that say anything about...
You tuned it out. Is that what you're sort of saying?
That's what I'm saying. Like, I couldn't...
I think that's because you've probably habituated to it. And habituation is actually a psychological phenomenon where it's where you first pay attention when a stimulus is presented, as you were saying, your dog barking. But over repeated exposure, you end up just not paying attention to it. And we learn this extremely young. Like, I think about... since birth, basically, because it's a necessary skill to have. Just think how annoying it would be if you heard your dog barking all the time so you couldn't get to sleep, or if you lived at an airport and you could not habituate to the sounds of the aeroplanes going overhead.
Mm. I think the interesting question would then be, if I heard another dog barking now, would I be habituating to that?
Depends how long you're exposed to the stimulus, I guess.
And, of course, there's some things you just can't tune out, no matter how much you really, really want to.
Mm-hmm. And that's the opposite, which is sensitization, which is if you've got, say, if you have a very annoying person that you just don't get along with and they're talking to you and you're just going, I wish that person would just, you know, shut up. And every time they speak, you're going to be very sensitized to what they're saying.
Can you also have positive sensitization, where the more you hear someone, the more you like what you hear, so it's not a negative thing?
Well, I'm not an expert, but yes, I do believe that that would happen as well.
I think the more I listen to Rove McManus, the more I hate him, so I think I don't know if that disproves or proves your theory, but...
Well, maybe the way to tune him out is to not care so much.
Scare it all.
Sadly, that's all we have time for in this edition of Diffusion. Warming the seats on this week's show were Ian Wolfe, Catherine B. Hagg, and Justin Zeltzer. If you'd like any information on any of the topics we dabbled in this week, if you think we should have written our own news instead of plagiarising an American newspaper from the 20s, or if you'd like to know why Channel Nowell records go platinum when no one admits to buying them, you can email us on diffusion@2scr.com. This week, Diffusion was produced in the luxurious studios of 2SER Sydney and is broadcast nationally via the Community Radio Network. According to the US government's no-fly list, I'm Matthew Clark, and I hope to see you back here next week for another round of science news and views on Diffusion.